From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
This is The Media Project, of course, as you have heard by the music coming in. That would be Pete Seeger with the terrific song that everybody thinks is the best part of the show. That aside, we're going to have to go ahead and talk anyway. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Sir.
Hi, Rex. Where you been?
I've been out west, Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada. Ira Fussfeld is here, also frequently a Western visitor.
Yes, I was in West Saugerties just this morning as I was driving.
For all of you who are listening in a different place, that's sort of Hudson Valley, New York.
Yes, it's in between my home in Woodstock and the New York State Thruway is West Saugerties.
And Caitlin Brown is here, head of the journalism program at the College of St. Rose. Where have you been?
At St. Rose, welcoming our brand new students. We're so excited.
Oh, that's great. You welcome students in the summertime?
Yes, we do. We have orientations and open houses, and it's a buzz over there.
A buzz.
Indeed.
Okay, well, we have a lot of topics to talk about, but first comes a piece of mail. You know, we always invite people to send their thoughts. And this, actually, Alan, this is more a question for you. Hello, says this writer from Al Plus, New York. Sorry, we shouldn't laugh. It only encourages him. Hello, I was a little surprised that NPR, in particular WAMC, broadcast live the media event constructed by the administration to announce the newest Supreme Court nominee. At the same time, I understood why this decision was made. Was there a conflict in the media about this live coverage, even as it seemed necessary? So why'd you do that, Alan?
Well, for the rest of, and I'm sure you would agree with this, Rex, because we don't agree on an awful lot, but you know, the idea that for the next 30 years or so, the Supreme Court of the United States now is going to have a conservative bent. But the Supreme Court is one of the most important institutions in the United States. Most people know that. And we wouldn't even think of not doing it live and hearing the president, who I don't have much use for, make that introduction.
Now, one of the
Is that a good answer?
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer, that it's an important thing. One of the interesting elements, though, is that the White House timed this, you know, to meet the top of the Hannity show. Clearly a payoff to the president's best friend in the media. This then, of course, was a great lead-in for the rest of the Hannity show on Fox. And I have a little number here. 25.6 million people watched on television as President Donald Trump announced Kavanaugh as his nominee. That compares to 32.4 million, slightly more, who saw the similar unveiling of Neil Gorsuch, his first nominee. But of course, the number one network for watching was Fox. Even though it's a cable network, it surpassed the others.
So we know that 90% of Republicans in this country are big fans of Donald Trump. So with that said, it is interesting to sort of see what's happening. You put it on, the Fox network gets the most because the people who approve of Trump are more likely to watch it than the people who disapprove of Trump, if you're following me. However, I will say that the timing, while it may be a little suspicious in terms of Hannity, is not unfamiliar to Americans because presidents tend to look for the best times that most people will be watching. 9 o'clock at night is not a bad time. So those are my thoughts on that.
I don't think anybody could criticize this radio station or any of the broadcast networks or cable networks for covering this speech live. It's certainly important, as Alan enumerated. The broader question, and it's one that was on our list of stories today, is the suggestion that
we have a list?
Yes, we do. You don't always look at it, but that's recognizable.
No, I not only don't look at it, I don't get it.
Oh, you don't get it. Well, the question that has been raised by a veteran journalist named Ezra Klein is whether or not the media should be paying as close attention as they are to the Trump rallies. And broadcasting the Trump rallies? And I think that's a very interesting question. I see that only Fox now is typically covering them wall to wall. The others are sort of looking in and using what they feel is important, which is the way it should be, I think. But I think as a general question, media executives are asking themselves, how much time and space do we give this guy, Trump, to spiel his usual routine of platitudes and lies and do it without any contradictions from journalists?
You know, it's interesting you say that, Ira, because this morning I happened to be watching Morning Joe. Now, Morning Joe used to be, you know, sort of certified Republican. He was a Republican congressman, I believe, from Florida. And this morning, they put Trump on MSNBC, which, of course, is the most liberal of all of the cable stations. And every time he told a lie, he would jump in while the president was on the air.
Right. Now, you're talking about this morning as we speak.
Yes.
And as he was giving a press conference as he was leaving NATO.
You are so profound in your help there.
But our listener here is asking, how do we determine when to cover an announcement from this administration? And it reminds me and harkens back to Sean Spicer. Remember him? Very first press conference when CNN decided not to run it live and instead to take a wait and see attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the current edition of the Journal of Media Ethics, that subject is vetted by a number of scholars. And I'm proud to say that I indeed wrote an article on this very topic about the determination of the media to wait sometimes. And in that instance, I thought CNN was justified. They expected that Spicer was going to get up there and tell stories about the size of the crowd at the inauguration. I know this is beating a dead horse, but it raises the bigger question. Is there value in sometimes waiting? And well, maybe not with the Supreme Court, which I agree that that should have run live. I understand why they delayed and just waited and to see what Spicer would do.
Well. First, just to make it clear to everybody that I think what you're talking about is not a presidential press conference, but the daily presidential briefing.
But it raises a bigger issue.
If the president did a press conference, if this president ever did a press conference, which he doesn't do.
Well, he did one as we speak this morning.
Not a full-fledged open.
Well, he was out there. What happens is he likes to go on when there's an international visitor sitting there with him.
But he has not, since becoming president, had an open press conference the way every other president has.
Yeah.
Maybe once, I
believe he had one relatively recently, but he went almost a year and a half without having one.
Yeah, and he considers the press the enemy of the people. We know that.
Well, we also know that he prefers Twitter. And what's really interesting about that, he prefers to talk directly to the American people via that platform. That platform announced this week that they intend to vet and essentially eliminate all of the false accounts throughout its entire platform, could be millions and millions of false accounts. I'm going to be very interested to see how the president's numbers change, as well as a number of other people.
Well, they'll get hell for it. This very morning, Morning Joe, that's what I was trying to say before you guys interrupted me.
Oh, yeah, you don't get a chance to speak on this station ever.
It's really awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, Morning Joe would interrupt as the president was speaking and say over his voice, "That's another lie, Mika. Wisconsin did vote for Ronald Reagan. And Trump was wrong when he said that. Another lie," said Morning Joe.
Yeah.
We don't have that much use for it.
Well, you know, and this is the thing that is interesting. When we talk about Fox News going live with some of these things, Fox, for example, carried live the rally in Montana. You know, the president went out to Montana to try to knock off John Tester, the incumbent Democratic senator out there, and did a rally, and Fox carried it live. The Washington Post fact checker analysis of that Montana rally found that 76% of his claims during that appearance were false, misleading, or lacking evidence. 76%. And yet, of course, Fox doesn't do analysis of the president's comments afterwards. Any politician whom a reporter covers whose claims are inaccurate, unfair, misleading, it is the fundamental responsibility of the reporter, whether you're covering the mayor, the town supervisor, and a member of the state legislature. The reporting is supposed to be something that holds them to account. Fox doesn't do that. Fox isn't practicing journalism when it comes to the president, which is why this problem of covering stuff live, as Kalin points out, is so pernicious.
Well, increasingly, as I said, Fox is the lone ranger yet again on this. The others are not doing the live coverage routinely, going wall to wall with him. The question that has been raised by this journalist, Ezra Klein, who's very well respected, he's suggesting these rallies shouldn't even be covered at all. I don't agree with that. I think you need to have cameras there. You need to have reporters there, but you need to report on it and put it in perspective and not just let it roll out there and give him a free rein. That doesn't serve the listeners or the readers any good.
Well, I agree with you, but think about this. The president of the United States in one of those very early times said, get him out of here and beat him up. Beat him up. Now, you would want to know that a president treated American citizens
without
that
a doubt,
way in the First Amendment.
Without a doubt. But that can be reported after the fact by editing the tape to show that portion of the speech or writing about it. If all you're doing is airing the speech live and watching him say, you know, beat him up, somebody's got to put all of this in perspective. And you're not doing that. You're not meeting your responsibilities when you just let him dribble on.
What would you think about a pool reporter, or if journalism could ever come to agree that perhaps we send fewer people to these events, something like an Associated Press writer or just several, and they could transition people in and out so that other reporters could be deployed to better stories?
Professor.
Yes,
if that's
professor.
If that's what you were doing, mm-hmm. If you were an editor of a major paper, mm-hmm. would you really trust the pool reporter as opposed to having the possibility of having your own person there?
Well, we trust pool reporters all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that that's what wire services are for.
That doesn't make it right, Rex.
Well, but we are the editors are already making the decision that Kalen is suggesting. If they feel they have the wherewithal to send a reporter, then that's fine. If they don't, they have the Associated Press, so they will not be without the news. I think most news organizations who have stature and money want to send their own person. But I'm not
suggesting. So you're on my side?
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we don't cover these things. I'm just suggesting that we use a little judgment, and the more time you devote to this stuff that does not deserve to have time devoted to it, the more time you're taking away or the more space you're taking away from other breaking news stories, which are arguably more important than the campaign-style speeches that he's made.
Which is the irony of us talking about it here. What about that What about that Daily News reporter who found out that the president is going to have to pay $44,000 more in taxes this year because he lied about where his permanent residence is? And his permanent residence is not in New York City, but it's in D.C.
Aha. Uh-huh. So. Well, take that. But it's really true. There is so much going on that we don't have time to do. And by letting, in the words of Ezra Klein, by the media letting President Trump be the assignment editor, we are getting away from so many stories. It's hard to look away. It's hard to not be there. I think you need to be at everything that the president does. My comparable experience when I was a reporter, when I first came to Albany to cover Governor Mario Cuomo, my predecessor, had said she believed that it was newsworthy whenever the governor spoke, that whatever the governor said, there needed to be a story. I took a different approach. I wanted to be there whenever the governor spoke. I went everywhere he did, but I didn't think that he necessarily made news whenever he spoke.
And I suspect that you were under quite a bit of pressure if you did not file a story that others filed.
Well, yes, but even more so nowadays, when we're more financially pressed, if you send a reporter on the road following a politician mm-hmm. and you get no story
right.
directly from it, you're going to think, well, why am I wasting my money on that?
Your editor is going to send you a little tickler to say, how come they had that and we didn't?
Well, that happened, I think I've told the story here before, when I was covering the Dukakis campaign, and this issue came up. George H.W. Bush, of course, made a big deal out of the Pledge of Allegiance. Do you remember long ago when Michael Dukakis had signed a bill in Massachusetts that allowed schools to not have to say the Pledge of Allegiance? Or I think he vetoed a bill that would have required the Pledge of Allegiance every day. So the campaign of 1988 became all about the flag. George H.W. Bush went to an American flag factory. He started his acceptance speech at the National Convention by saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And this became a running thing of the Bush campaign. I was in Cleveland or Cincinnati covering a public housing thing where Dukakis was unveiling his stance on housing. And my editor, when I called in from a payphone in those days, said to me, Can you match this AP story on the flag that they've got? There was some little tick, a little development in the flag story. I couldn't, in fact, match the story. I hadn't been on the press plane, the AP was. So they took the AP story, and my piece about housing, which was an important issue in the 88 campaign, was reduced to a single paragraph on the campaign page that day.
Okay, so you put yourself in the head of the editor, mm-hmm. and the editor is making an assessment on what story is more important by figuring out which is most digestible by the people who are reading the paper, right? In other words, are they more likely to understand and get involved in a story about whether to say the Pledge of Allegiance, which their kids had to do, which they had to do when they were kids, or are they more likely to be interested in the complexities of public housing? It's that simple.
You're right. I mean, that's very hard to combat that. What do people want? What do they understand?
What does the professor think about that?
I think that people have to be willing to be intellectually challenged, and the American public needs to step up and learn what's happening.
Well, that's so professorial of you, but the fact of the matter is they're not willing to step up. They're not willing to intellectually engage everything they hear. They just want to do stuff that makes them most comfortable. And remember, half of them don't even vote.
But I think a high percentage of families in the United States hope that their children will get a valuable education so they can advance and prosper more than they had. I think that's typically the American dream, and education is at the foundation of that. So the more well-educated we are, the better decisions we should make.
Well, Professor, I agree with you when you say that. I mean, who could disagree with that, except that, again, we're engaged in a dialogue over what should be and what is. And what is the newspaper editor like Rex sitting there with a cigar in his mouth, you know, people reporting to him. And, you know, he knows what'll sell the potatoes. He's not going to be shoving stuff down people's throats.
He's not making decisions based on what's going to sell newspapers. I'm sorry, Rex, I should not speak on your behalf.
You know, it's always a challenge to decide how you're going to cover what's popular versus what's important. You know, your front page, for example, has to have both news that must be there because it's interesting, even if it's not important, and stuff that is important, even if it's not all that interesting.
Okay, so now how would you play, or put it a different way, how do the three of you think the coverage was of the boys stuck in the cave in Thailand? Now, I happen to think it was an interesting story. I understand why people were interested in the story, and it had a feel-good ending, and everybody's happy about that. I think the story was entirely overcovered in this country. We became engrossed by something that, in the big picture, was not terribly important, other than to the 12 boys and their family.
Yes, but sometimes it's valuable to give people a story that just affirms their humanity. Sometimes
exactly.
We are just giving people the truth of what goes on, and it's the human experience that identifies us as being part of a world community. And I think that has some meaning to it also.
Well, Rex, let me argue that one with you. I mean, if, in fact, we are now balancing our news between what will make people feel better, because this is a tough time in the United States. We all know it. We're playing very depressing news, and a lot of people know it's very depressing and the rest of it. So let's throw them a piece of red meat, which will make them feel better. It doesn't really do the job of making sure that they're getting what they need to get in the context they ought to be getting it.
Well, but I think there's a place, you know, it's always a terrible job for a young reporter to be sent by an editor to go knock on the door and say, you know, somebody has died, and you go knock on the survivor's door, the family, and say, in effect, how does it feel? It's a terrible job for a reporter, but that helps knit us together as humans. The empathy of that story is part of the human experience that we hope we don't individually have to experience, but that by putting that as part of your journalism report, you're giving people a full picture of the world of humanity.
Well, you and I have duked this out any number of times. You have denied, you basically say that the newspapers and the good radio and TV places are just covering stories. They're not injecting themselves into it. But by saying that, Rex, when people deserve to have a balance in the good news and bad news and the rest of it, You're basically the decider, and
yeah.
you, Rex Smith, are making that decision.
It's my job.
And you're that's right. And
yep.
So I don't think we should ever have this fight again, you and I, about whether you inject yourselves and your values into the news.
Didn't say I did. I think you were misquoting me there. I put values into it. I actually do. And I think one of the values that I bring to it is that I think our readers need to have that dose of humanity. You know, we're a local newspaper. We didn't put the 12 boys trapped in the cave on the front page, but we did have stories about it. And I think it was a story that was, maybe it got overplayed. Is that your point, Ari? You think it
yeah,
too
I mean,
much?
And you, what you just said is accurate and proper. You're a local newspaper and you printed the story, but you had it inside. I think as it relates to the larger news organizations, including TV, the story clearly was interesting and it should be reported. The question is, how much time are you devoting to this story and what is it that you're leaving out if you're covering a disproportionate amount of time on this story, which in the big picture is relatively unimportant, granted all of the reasons that it is interesting and important, humanity and all the rest. That the fact is, it was a relatively small story in the context of the big world picture.
Well, but Ira, from Kingston, New York, if those 12 boys had been trapped in a cave in Kingston,
yes,
that would have been a very
absolutely, story. No doubt about it. And if the boys had been trapped in a cave in Colorado, it probably would have been a bigger story.
Sure.
In There's Thailand, less so.
A very thoughtful analysis of this that I commend to our listeners. You can't do a hot link on the radio, but if you want to Google Roy Peter Clark, who is the Poynter Institute, and he talks about Mentor's List. Melvin Mentor was my mentor at Columbia, and he talks about the Mentor List.
So Mentor was your mentor?
Mentor was the mentor. That's true.
He was a mensch.
So it's about this whole question of determining newsworthiness, and he goes into, Roy Peter Clark ends up with three relevant categories of newsworthiness: the unusual, conflict, and currency. So it really comes down into all kinds of reasons why certain stories get attention and certain stories do not. We don't tell the story of every child who is in mortal danger. We have to pick and choose.
But we do a lot, Rex, and if some kid falls down a well anywhere, or especially in America, we're going to hear about that story until that kid is either dead or out.
Well, Clark's article is telling us that these stories fit the bill. They qualify as stories because they meet the criteria outlined in Mentor's textbook. So, and it's taught in journalism classrooms now. Mentor's still taught.
I don't give a damn what is taught in the classroom. I think that the classroom...
Wait, weren't you a teacher?
Often.
Yeah. Wasn't that a thing?
And I thought I brought something...
You're killing me.
I thought I brought to it a little something different than what the traditional way of doing...
Some would say
teaching.
Odd. Mm-hmm.
Okay, what did you just say? Some
nothing,
would say
nothing, nothing, nothing. Go right ahead.
I thought I heard something.
is the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, Kalen Brown, and Rex Smith. By the way, pay attention to something that Ken Tingley said. Ken Tingley is the editor of the Post Star, which is the fine local newspaper up in Glens Falls, New York. The Post Star, which is right on the edge of the Adirondacks, and it's within the listening area of WAMC, where this program originates, he says his paper will focus entirely on where the candidates stand on the issues in the fall campaign. Quote, we will no longer quote campaign spokespeople or other representatives. We believe that newspapers like ourselves are too often used as the conduit for attacking the opposing candidate. If either candidate wants to criticize the other, we will report what they have to say, but we will not quote campaign henchmen. The candidate will have to do so directly. Interesting.
I think that's great. Some years ago, we stopped printing letters to the editor during the election campaign if the letter essentially said, vote for my guy, he's a nice guy.
Right.
We said, if you have issues you want to discuss, if it's an issue-based letter, we'll consider publishing it. But there's too much of what Ken is talking about, and they should be careful about what's printed.
Well, Ira, don't you think that letter writers are smart? And if you say to them...
Letter writers or readers?
Writers. And that if they say, you say to them, well, you're not getting in the paper unless you raise an issue. You can't just say vote for my guy. They'll give you your issue.
Well, maybe, but that's fine. That's what we wanted. We want issues.
Well, it seems to me it's a little phony.
Well, the way I'm hearing this, Tingley's saying they're going to work around the public relations people, the spokespeople. That's a big deal. Those people exist to share the information on behalf of their candidates. What will their purpose be if not to interact with the media on behalf of their candidates? So it raises interesting questions about the spokespeople.
To obstruct and obfuscate. Isn't that the job?
The dark side.
And remembering that most of them came from you guys. They went over there and got twice the money they were getting.
And some of us went over there and came back.
And they went to the dark side.
And by the way, speaking of Ken Tingley, RIP to George Waters, a veteran newspaper man in Rome, New York, died earlier this month at age 98. And he was a very well-known figure in New York State journalism.
Terrific. On that point, we will have to end the Media Project.
No.
It's true.
It'll be an hour.
I'm so sorry.
And it's Rex's fault. Well, if you want it to be an hour, you got to write to Rex.
Oh, boy. Alan Chartok, Ira Busfield.
At TimesUnion.com.
Kalen Brown and Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us.
What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.